Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast where I, your host, Scott McNulty, talk about a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest today is Chip Sarath. Chip, thank you for joining me.
It is a pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
You're welcome. So polite. So Chip, tell the people who are listening a little bit about yourself. How might they know you?
They might know me from a couple of podcasts. I've been doing the audio guide to Babylon 5 with incomparable regular Erica Ensign and my wife Shannon Sutterth, also of a recent Random Trek, where we are going episode by episode in sequential, not random order, through the Babylon 5 story every 2 weeks. So it's going to take us 5 years to get through the whole 5-year series. And I'm probably better known for 2-Minute Time Lord, which is a super brief regular podcast about Doctor Who that's been going since about 2009, 2010, about 5 years now.
That is a long time in internet years.
In podcasting years, I'm like 5-6 dogs old or something like that. I don't know.
Is that how one podcast year is like 6 dogs? I don't know what that means, but I like it.
One podcast years is probably kind of like 5 attempted startups of podcasts or something. I don't know.
That is true. So you talk about Babylon 5. Well, you mentioned it because you have a podcast about it. Doing so, Shannon, your wife, was on the previous episode, episode 33. And we spoke a little bit about the difference between – the biggest difference between Babylon 5 and a lot of Star Trek is that Babylon 5 had this overarching story that it kind of built towards, and it had this big plot line, and you kind of had to watch a lot of the episodes in order, obviously, to get the whole picture, whereas in many Star Trek franchises, super episodic. You could watch them randomly if you were crazy, and you wouldn't really miss much. So doing a random Babylon 5 podcast, it would seem to me, would be an error.
If not an error, it would probably be one heck of a drinking game if you took a shot every time you encountered something out of continuity.
And I was explaining to Shannon that I have never seen much of Babylon 5. I think I did say to Shannon I hadn't seen any Babylon 5, but I think I've seen a little bit of it because it didn't catch me. I didn't like latch onto it immediately. And then when I tried to get into it, I didn't have any idea of what was going on.
Right. Yeah, there's sort of a sweet spot there. Babylon 5 and Star Trek, obviously the fandoms back in the day, this is in the early days of sort of the popular use of Usenet and other online media and things like that. These were two fandoms that were just absolutely at each other's throats. And Star Trek was so much more polished than B5 that it's really – You had to commit yourself to B5 to really get into it back in the day. And by the time it started getting really good, and it is, and at its best, it's really extraordinary television. You like I'm assuming was your experience. You know, when it got to that point, if you didn't find one of the few gateway episodes, you would be completely lost, and there would be so much stuff to sort of get past. Whereas Star Trek is episodic in the best way, and you can dip in, and it is so polished that is sometimes a pejorative among B5 fans that Star Trek, especially at this time, Next Generation is in its 5th or 6th season, DS9 is getting off the ground. Some of the B5 fans had turned their nose up at Star Trek because it was so clean and so pretty and so well produced.
How dare they have a well produced TV show?
Yeah, I'm a Doctor Who fan, so well, I've got my own biases. You know, much like Deb Stanish did when she was on your show. We're talking about, you know, some of us fans have deep suspicions of things that are done technically well.
And I was interested in Babylon 5 because, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was one of the first shows that they used like CGI for the ships, right? Is that right?
Right. As a matter of fact, one of our first emails to the B5 audio guide, the audio guide to Babylon 5 podcast, was from Adam Mojo Leibowitz, who was one of the visual effects gurus for Foundation Imaging, which did the special effects for the first three seasons of Babylon 5. And then I'm not sure about all of the backstage plottings, machinations, backstabbings, whatever it was. But Foundation, with the fourth season of Babylon 5, left and actually started working for Paramount. So the same visual effects crew that were responsible for the first three seasons are suddenly bringing their CGI wizardry to Paramount and to the Star Trek franchises. And all of a sudden, a lot of people who said that B5 sucked because they didn't use models, all of a sudden Star Trek starts increasingly using CGI. And, you know, it worked out, I think, well for both franchises.
It is true. And I think the Star Trek probably got the better end of that deal only because the technology had matured so quickly that I only remember the first few moments that I saw the first episode of Babylon 5, and I thought, well, those ships look interesting, but they look kind of crappy as compared to my ever-faithful love of the Star Trek models that I had known. And so those ships looked great, but it was just that, you know, the technology just wasn't there quite yet, and they were ahead of their time. And so Star Trek basically, I think, waited until they could take all the learning from the Babylon 5 folks and apply it to their own universe.
I think that's probably likely. But you know, over the 7 years, you know, I've been taking advantage of the fact that you invited me on to sort of dip back into episodes here and there, and just watching the progression of the show from beginning to end, as the technology improves, as the you know, just the space scenes alone,
mm-hmm.
you're going from some fairly static stuff early on to all the way to the end to All Good Things, when they break one of the cardinal rules of Star Trek ship sequences, when the future Enterprise with the extra gun and all that stuff that the future Commander Captain Riker is flying flies opposite the sort of flat plane that so many Star Trek battles happen. You know, just following that that evolution, if you will, of the series from beginning to end, it's been wonderful to see. When Next Gen was on, I was a diehard fan, to the extent that if I knew what they looked like, I possibly would have built a shrine to Rick Sternbach and Michael Okuda, who were responsible for so many of those wonderful guides and encyclopedias and chronology books and things like that. I owned them all. So Star Trek is not as big a part of my life today, but it was such a big part when I was younger, and it's been wonderful dipping back in.
Well, I'm glad I could be the conduit for this rediscovery, perhaps, of your Star Trek love. So when you were younger, you were a fan. Do you consider yourself now still a fan of Star Trek?
More an appreciator. I mean, I'm a Babylon 5 fan. I'm a Doctor Who fan. When I define fan as, am I remotely tempted to dress up in a costume? Not saying that I would. not saying that I would, but am I tempted?
Not that there's anything wrong with dressing up in a costume.
Not at all. But I think that I'm past my Star Trek spandex days.
Yeah, I never had Star Trek spandex days, so I have often thought. Well, not often, but now that I have a Star Trek podcast, I think if I had to dress up as a Star Trek character, what Star Trek character would most be fitting my physique? And it's certainly not a Starfleet uniform, I can tell you that much.
Well, I mean, but you've got the beard. I mean,
well, that's true. I could be a chubby Riker. but I think I'd probably be a Klingon, in case anyone is keeping track at home what character Scott would dress up as. Probably a Klingon. So we were talking before recording And you said that you were in college. You were involved in kind of a was it a fan club or
I was involved in a science fiction fantasy fan club at the University of North Carolina that was called Chimera, and the folks that I hung out with all had very strong opinions of Star Trek: The Next Generation. This was in 1988, 1989 or so, and for the most part, they did not appreciate it. This was a pretender to the throne. The original series was the be all and end all, and there was this wonderful moment where we're all in a floor lounge in one of the dormitories, and we're watching Star Trek: The Next Generation as we do. Not because we like it, but it's almost a hate watch. It was a hate watch for them. I was enjoying it. When I was younger, I was a big Buck Rogers in the 25th Century fan. So I may not have been the most discerning. I vividly remember the annual hate watching beginning. The weekly hate watching beginning again. And the episode that came on was The Measure of a Man. Mm-hmm. And the part when Riker shuts Data off, because through the contrivance of the script, you know, he's got to prove that Data is not sentient. And the folks in the room were just terrifically horrified and offended on Data's behalf, and in the back of my head saying, "This is not a hate watch. You guys have bought in on this thing.
Somewhere you crossed the line."
Yeah. And over the years, it was nice to see Next Gen become more and more accepted. Certainly, the increasing quality of the episodes as it went along had a lot to do with it. But also, I think just getting over the sense of ownership over the old thing so much that anything else that comes after it has to be a pretender or cannot possibly be as good. Right. You know,
or it's trying to replace the original series in some way.
Absolutely. And, you know, the episode that you've invited me to talk about, I think is, while this episode in itself may not be the turning point, there's a lot of stuff that happens in season three of Next Generation where things just start coming together. And even this episode, I think, has a lot of hints to that.
Well, why don't we just jump into this episode, which is Evolution, which is, in fact, the first episode of season three. And I should point out, we talked about special effects and things that I watched. So they reissued the original series on Blu-ray, and I've talked to death about how beautiful it is, and it looks great in HD, and they spent all this time redoing all the special effects, and it's great. And it is. They also did that for The Next Generation, and it's also fantastic. So if you have a Blu-ray player, or if you have access to a streaming service that streams Star Trek The Next Generation in HD, you should certainly watch it in HD just to look at it, even if you're a purist and you want to see the original special effects, because they redo them. You should at least check it out just because it looks beautiful. And I've watched Evolution in the digitally remastered or restored or whatever they're calling it, Blu-ray pristine kind of with a fancy new special effects. And it looked beautiful.
I wanted to make sure that I was doing you right, Scott. So to be perfectly authentic in my Star Trek immersion. Mm-hmm. I watched both. Netflix does not stream the HD version yet, as far as I could tell. So I watched it in classic SD on Netflix, and then on iTunes has the first five seasons in HD. So I watched it a second time. Boy, that the young Will Wheaton's pancake makeup doesn't hide nearly as much adolescence as it did in SD.
I wanted to talk about that. I'm glad you watched it in both SD and HD, because I wanted to spend at least a little moment talking about this because, yes, poor Will Wheaton has a lot of acne, as many teenagers do. But they were shooting in SD, so they thought, you know, no one's going to see it. Then you remaster it in HD, and hey, you can see it. And you can also see the episode starts off and they show this pan across of some props. And they show this computer console that I'm sure looked fine in SD, but looks like it's seen better days in HD.
Yeah.
And I noticed a couple of obviously you can't go back in time and, you know, shoot for HD because they didn't even know it was going to happen. But there's also some sliding doors that have glass in them that I noticed that the glass is super dirty. And it just made me chuckle just because these are things that you never saw in SD. So they just never thought about it because, you know, who cares if there are handprints all over this glass? No one's ever going to see it. It's in the background. It's not even in focus. No one's going to notice until they go back and remaster it. And then you could see all this crazy stuff.
Right. Although I didn't think any of this stuff was as jarring as, you know, as lovingly remastered as the original series is. What I've seen, you know, I do have this mental breakdown when we get to the new CGI, the new mm-hmm. space scenes. And I have none of these issues with watching the remastered Next Generation. It is, yeah, if you have to, you can squint and get past the acne.
Yes. And I think, I mean, it looks, for the original series, it is so clearly different that it can be quite jarring. For the Next Generation, I feel like it was close enough that they just kind of oomphed it up. So it looks pretty much the same, except it looks good on HD now. So, and I thought in this particular episode, they have this binary star thing that looks beautiful. Because they've redone it. And the Enterprise, of course, which I'm sure is a CG model now, looks lovely. thank you, Babylon 5.
It starts out beautifully. The effects are great. The initial angle of the Enterprise is a little different from what we saw in the first couple of seasons. That sort mm-hmm. of back, that back into the top sort of thing.
Not behind it.
Not behind it. Not right beside it. And of course, the first thing you notice is that we've fallen into a parallel universe where there are collars now.
That's right. You wanted to talk about how the uniforms have changed.
Yeah. I mean, well, this is the first, and the uniform change was largely because the cast was rebelling. The old costumes were just not at all comfortable, and some of them were complaining about back problems. But especially in HD, of course. But it's just another indication with a better special effects. And the different look of the characters, things are just starting to feel different.
It's starting to click, I think.
They really are. And the costume changes are not a reason for this, but they're a signal for this, especially for somebody who's been watching it, that, you know, if you're in collar territory, your chances of a good episode are significantly higher.
That is very true. I had never thought about that, but the costumery does lend itself. Like, for example, Star Trek The Motion Picture, pastels. Never watch a Star Trek that features pastel uniforms. You're just going to be disappointed. That's my tip to you, people in the audience. So anyway, we open with an acneed Will Wheaton playing Wesley Crusher. Yes, this is a Wes episode, so people who don't like Wesley Crusher should skip it, because he plays a major role in that he starts a new civilization. Who one can only assume he is a god to these nanites. Spoiler alert. he's asleep in the lab. He's been working hard, I suppose. And Riker says, "Hey, Wes, you should be on the bridge because it's your time to do your little shift." So Wes gets up. He's very abashed. He closes a little tin thing and he runs off to the bridge. And we get this weird kind of thing that I think highlights the Riker School of Management, that when Wes comes onto the bridge, Riker points his finger at Wes and follows him the entire time until he sits down at navigation, which I thought was very amusing.
Yeah.
He was like, I see you, and you're still late. But anyway, that, the whole point of this episode is that this dude, Dr. What's his name? Dr. Stubbs.
Dr. Paul Stubbs.
He is here because he is an astrophysicist, and he has this egg that is a probe, basically, and they are at this binary star system, and every 194 years, I think it is, it explodes, and lots of stuff happens, and he wants to... He thinks that he will redefine astrophysics with his probe, and so he's here to make sure that happens and launch it. And the Enterprise is the launch pad for his probe, basically.
And then yes. all of a sudden it's time for the camera to shake.
That's right. And, oh, this is one of my favorite moments of this episode. So the ship does this little shimmy thing. Everyone throws themselves. The actor who plays Dr. Stubbs really throws himself into being hurled across the bridge. And he really gets into it. And he's like, he bodily is lifted off the floor, flies against the wall, rolls back, hits it again. It's quite violent. It doesn't look comfortable. the big thing is they're like, computer, what's going on? And the computer says, everything's fine. What are you talking about? And the shields won't go up, and now they're drifting into this binary star system towards certain doom. And that's the beginning of the episode.
And we get new special effects in the opening credits.
Mm-hmm.
Again, just a little sense that they're trying harder. You know, this is when we have our the nebulas and the cloudy galaxies and all this stuff, and a relatively seamless transition into the old credit sequences. But again, it's one of those things that makes the viewer sit up and pay attention.
That's right. It looks more polished and like they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because they do at this point, one imagines. So we come back to the episode and credits are over. The new fancy credits are over. People are freaking out because the Enterprise is about to be destroyed. They basically do a whole bunch of manual overrides on the shields and they think that the inertial disrupt dampeners are offline. But suddenly as it started, everything starts to act normal again. This is when Picard asks the computer what the nature of the malfunction was, and the computer says there was no malfunction, and everyone is confused. And so Dr. Stubbs, who has been apparently has a horrible spinal injury, is brought to sickbay, and this is where we see that... Good old Dr. Crusher is back. The fans of the show may remember that in season 2, Dr. Crusher was not around. Dr. Pulaski was the ship's doctor. And now Dr. Crusher's back.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about Dr. Pulaski?
Dr. Pulaski was all right. I thought that she was a good experiment, trying to bring a little edge to the show.
Mm-hmm.
We B5 fans tend to snark a bit about the lack of conflict between lead characters, and especially in the Next Generation. But Pulaski starting off as referring to Data as it instead of he,
mm-hmm.
it was a nice little bit. But bringing Beverly back. It's really interesting because it's in this episode in particular, she and Gates McFadden and Will Wheaton actually get to act like a proper mother and child,
mm-hmm.
especially believably so, having been separated for about a year. So I like this scene right here where she complains about having missed about 2 inches of him mm-hmm. of him while she was gone, and there's affection there, but there's also awkwardness, and I like the way that sort of comes over. It's good characterization. This is a good Wesley episode, I think, but it's also a good episode for Beverly Crusher and even Jean-Luc Picard, when they have that scene that's coming up, they all get to act believably human, which was something that Next Gen sometimes had a bit of a problem with.
It's true. It was plot over character for many episodes. And this is really the whole point of this episode is exploring the relationship between Wes and his mother. And, you know, she's been gone for a year. Now she's back. And, you know, during that year, Wes's life didn't stop. He continued doing whatever it is Wesley Crusher does on the Enterprise, you know, make new civilizations, pilot the ship, the course of whatever. And so there's this scene where, you know, Dr. Crusher is fixing up the back of Dr. Stubbs, and Wesley comes in, and he says, well, you know, I don't think I'd want to be on a ship with my mother.
Yeah.
Which I thought was nice. And made me think, recently my mother has moved to Philadelphia, so I understand how having your mother in proximity changes things a bit. We're not living together, but it's still... It struck a note with me.
Did it?
It.
Are you saying you don't want her to do a random trek with you?
I don't think she understands what podcasts are, so that's probably not an issue. Nor is she interested in Star Trek. So many, many points. I love you, Mom, if you're listening, which you're not, because you don't even know this exists. But yeah, that's not going to happen. She's more of a Babylon 5 fan, so maybe she'll go on your podcast.
I'll make a note of it.
Oh, excellent. So they fix up the doctor. They have an awkward conversation about, you know, Wes and his mother. And then the food slot is malfunctioning in sickbay. And the Dr. Crusher's like, computer fixed the malfunction in the food slot, which leads me to believe that these Starfleet people are very lazy about fixing things because they just order the computer to do it. Nobody actually tries to fix anything themselves. The computer says, there's nothing wrong with the food slot, lady. So she says, hey, cut the power to the food slot. And then it stops because the food slot is apparently creating a never-ending glass of Kool-Aid or something.
Yeah.
So the other part weird things are happening on the Enterprise. We don't know why, but we've got a lot going on so far. We've got Wesley Crusher and his relationship with his mom. We've got this Dr. Stubbs dude who seems kind of arrogant and single-focused. And we've got malfunctioning Enterprise bits and bobs everywhere. So it's all leading to something. We don't know what, though.
No.
And the other thing – so Wesley Crusher. Let's talk about Wesley Crusher for a second. Because as I was watching this episode, Wesley talks about how he's not even a Starfleet cadet yet, but he's earning credits with his work on the Enterprise. And part of his work on the Enterprise is piloting the ship. And I was thinking to myself, as I often do as I watch Star Trek, what would I think if I were a crew member on the Enterprise? And so, you know, all like the junior crew members on the Enterprise have all gone through Starfleet. They've gone through years of training. They show up. They're on the flagship of the Federation. It's all very exciting. And then they find out that someone who hasn't even gone through any training is piloting the ship. And I've got to believe that the third shift navigator is super annoyed that some lousy kid is piloting the Enterprise with Captain Picard.
You mean, and how about that guy? How about that poor guy who had to vacate his chair while Riker points Wesley into the seat because Wesley is late, because Wesley overslept, and that guy has to surrender the spot to Wesley.
He spent like 8 years learning how to fly the Enterprise, and he has to get out because Wesley has finally arrived.
Oh, the shut up Wesley phenomenon and the Wesley saves the ship or Wesley's science experiment breaks the ship or whatever that stuff, you know, some of that stuff comes across in this episode and some of it is a little regrettable. On the other hand, this is one of those times when Will Wheaton is given something to do other than be the boy genius. He's got to deal with guilt and awkward relationships with his mom and things like that, and a No spoilers for the spoilers for the end of the episode, but you know, Wesley makes a clear accomplishment at the end of this episode in 10 forward. He's a problematic character, but this is one of its best episodes, I think.
I agree, and mostly because, like you already said, he's just playing a smart teenager, right? He's not playing like a super genius. He has a problem with his mom, kind of, you know, getting on his case because, you know, there have many moments in this episode where, you know, Dr. Crusher is back after a year, so she kind of wants to figure out what's going on with Wesley. And Wesley, like I said before, has been doing stuff. So there's a moment when the ship is under red alert and Wesley is not in his quarters, and he gets a call from his mom, and she says, "Wesley, I stopped by your quarters because that's where you should be, but you weren't there." And he's like, "Gosh, Mom, I do things too." The plot is very straightforward, so I'll just get it out of the way that we can talk about stuff in it. So basically what happens is Wesley was experimenting with nanobots in very poor conditions, like lab conditions, because he fell asleep. And he was training these two nanobots to basically teach each other how to be better at being nanobots. But he fell asleep without closing the container, so they escaped. And then they ran off and started eating the ship's computer.
And making little bitty nanobites.
Exactly, that are evolving and being better and better at being themselves. And then they eat more and more of the computer. The computer's getting all eaten up, so it can't function correctly. So we get a lot of great scenes where the computer's just doing weird stuff, like playing Stars and Stripes Forever on all frequencies everywhere, that was like my favorite part of this episode because it was just so funny. And so everyone is very confused about what's going on. Geordi figures out that basically the chips are disintegrating, but they don't know why. Dr. Stubbs is single-mindedly focused on getting his probe launched, but the computer is malfunctioning, so they can't do that. Captain Picard and Dr. Stubbs have tension because Captain Picard wants to save his crew, and there's a scene where Dr. Stubbs is like, "I would rather die than leave," to which Captain Picard says, "I think the rest of the crew would disagree with you." And so Dr. Stubbs, they figure out basically that these nanites are eating up the computer. Dr. Stubbs is like, "Well, let's eradicate them because they're pests." Everybody else is like, "Well, they might be intelligent, so we shouldn't just kill off this whole species," which is a big leap. But it turns out that they were right. They are intelligent. Dr. Stubbs, being impatient, kills a bunch of them with a little gamma ray gun that he gets from someplace. Which then leads to them trying to kill him, and Data points out that you have now proven, since they reacted to your actions, that they are intelligent. Haha, Dr. Stubbs, you fool. And then they use Data as a vehicle to communicate with the crew, and then they decide that they are intelligent. They have outgrown the Enterprise, and Dr. Stubbs somehow manages to get them a planet, and they go off to live on this planet. And Dr. Stubbs' probe is launched, and everybody's happy. So that's the plot.
Yeah. As linear plots go, it's right down the middle.
It is right down the middle, but there are a lot of good stuff in there, and I just wanted to get that out of the way because I wanted to talk a little bit about the character of Dr. Stubbs, because he is basically Wesley Crusher in 30 years, maybe.
It's right. A cautionary tale.
He is a cautionary tale because he was, as he says, a Wunderkind in a conversation with Wesley, where he talks about how when he was a precocious young kid and he was super smart, and one of the biggest adversaries that he ever faced was living up to his own potential. So he tells Wesley to, you know, he's passing along the torch of being a genius to Wesley, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Wes is like, okay. And yeah, so he is a tortured soul who spent 20 years working on this probe. And he is very zealous in making sure that it works. And so he is willing to eradicate a whole new intelligent species in order to launch his probe, which is, is not what you should be doing. So he's a cautionary tale.
This could be you, Wesley. You could be a bitter, vengeful 50-something killing civilizations of nanite things.
So be careful. And of course, Dr. Stubbs also, you know he's no good because not only is he a baseball fan, but he's like a sabermetrics baseball fan. So he has memorized all the stats and he replays baseball games in his mind based only on statistics. So that's always a sign that the character is not good.
he's an interesting character. I kind of liked the actor's performance. I liked the way that he's so single-minded. Mm-hmm. And he's one of these really abrasive academics. No time for social graces, nothing left. You know, the sort of person who would play back baseball games in his head is not the sort of person who would have a whole lot of patience for everything else that's going on. So I thought that there's some really good sparks between him and Patrick Stewart. Picard, he's got contempt for Picard for playing it safe. Picard's got contempt for Stubbs for not seeing the bigger picture here. Mm-hmm. It's just nice to see that sort of back and forth between them.
Yeah, the actor does a great job of with Dr. Stubbs, and I think I really do enjoy the Captain Picard Dr. Stubbs scenes because you can, you know, Dr. Stubbs is like, I represent the highest levels of authority in the Federation and you have to do what I say, and Captain Picard's like, I don't think so. we'll make sure the crew is safe first and then there'll be time to shoot your little probe out.
What did you think about the interactions between him and Counselor Troy? I thought that was interesting because it sort of lampshades the problem with Troy's character. And you know, she says he's serious, and Picard says, you know, I could tell that. And that's sort of there as a given. But even so, she and Stubbs sort of have that sort of back and forth at them, and that second scene in Stubbs' quarters is pretty good as far as her sort of giving back as good as she gets.
Yes, where she kind of confronts him and says, you know, you have this portrait of yourself that you've painted, and it's very tight, and I'm afraid it's going to break, and when it breaks, you're going to hurt somebody. And then he has this kind of weird I guess not weird, but it's just – it gives you a look into his character where his response basically is, well, Counselor Troy, sometimes when you look under this portrait, what you find is nothing. So he's all surface. What you see is what you get is basically what he's saying. He is a jerk, and that's all. You dig a little further in, and you just find more jerk.
it's jerk all the way down.
That's right. But yeah, I think – I mean, Counselor Troy, let's talk about Counselor Troy. She doesn't do too much in this episode other than have a little spark with Dr. Stubbs where he – and I liked when he said she was basically in that meeting you were talking about. She was basically telling Captain Picard, he's serious or he really feels that way. And he's like, Counselor Troy, I can express my emotions myself. Thank you very much. Get your beam out of my mind, which – you know, it does. It highlights a problem, as you said, with her character in that she doesn't really do too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would like to. I hope this is a good time to mention that this is actually the first episode that is written by one Michael Piller.
Ah.
Who is brought in later on in this season to be the script editor. Remains the script editor for the duration of Star Trek: The Next Generation. And he brings so much. He brings so much to the show. I think he's the biggest reason why the show leaps forward in quality. And some of the stuff that he brings to this script include the tension between Wes and his mom, and the fight later on when he yells at her that she wasn't even there. That she had no business judging him because she wasn't even on the ship for a whole year. Between that and Counselor Troy, where you lampshade the problems with the character and then you just go forward anyway.
Right.
And sort of move beyond that. I love the writing of this episode for everything except perhaps with the Dr. Frankenstein references that Guinan makes, because that's a fictional character, damn it. aside from that, I like the writing of this one.
I was just going to talk about that scene with Guinan. So Guinan appears in this episode, and basically she is another cautionary tale, basically, for Wes. He is setting traps in 10 Forward to capture nanites. It doesn't matter why. Guinan finds him, and she's like, hey, what are you doing? And he says, you know, I think I unleashed these nanites, and it was just an experiment. And as Chip just said, she says, well, that's what Dr. Frankenstein said. And then she says, well, do you think you'll get an A? And he says, I always get an A. And he walks away, very dejected. And Guinan says, Dr. Frankenstein always got A's too. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
I'm not sure Dr. Frankenstein went to school.
Oh, yeah. But that's another good scene for Wesley. And again, lampshading the problems with these characters. Mm-hmm. Wesley is the perfect boy genius. And in this episode, we see that that's actually a fairly heavy cross to bear. You know, it doesn't work for him all that well.
Yeah, he's pretty dejected. He's tired. He's missing, he's having trouble with his mom. And he could end up replaying baseball games in his mind. Nobody wants that. Guinan does have – I thought Guinan also has a scene with Dr. Crusher where Dr. Crusher is basically let's skip that to the very end, basically. Guinan is in 10 Forward. Dr. Crusher's in 10 Forward talking to Guinan about, you know, oh, I'm so, you know, what do I do with Wes? Have you ever had any trouble with your children? And Guinan has this funny thing where she says, yes, one of my sons just wouldn't listen to anybody. And Dr. Crusher's like, well, that doesn't seem so bad. And Guinan points out, well, when you're from a race of listeners, it's a problem. But give him a couple hundred years and he was all fine. One of the big things I don't think we mentioned is that Dr. Crusher is concerned about Wes because he seems like he's all work and no fun. And he's 17 and he should be having some fun. He shouldn't be falling asleep in a lab creating nanite civilizations. He should be, you know, carousing with his friends, though he doesn't.
He should be having fun instead of teaching nanites how to reproduce. That's just a little too kinky for me. I'm just saying.
Well, some people think that's fun. So, you know, judge not, lest ye be judged, Chip. And so at that moment, Wes walks in with a lady, a teenage girl, not on his arm, but it is clear they are together. And they go towards a group of teenagers, which you never see on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
Except for this very moment, there seem to be a gaggle of teenagers that just hang out in 10 Forward that Wes joins, and he's having fun. And that makes Dr. Crusher feel better. I am not a huge Wesley Crusher fan, mostly because they use him in annoying ways. But this episode is, I think, one of the best, if not the best, Wesley Crusher episode, which is perhaps damning it with faint praise. But I did enjoy the episode. So how about you? What did you think of the episode overall?
I liked it a fair bit. It slows down towards the end because it is very much committed to the next generation mantra that not every alien is hostile, not every threat is hostile. We're all more evolved than that. Stubbs is clearly the bad guy because he's taking the most pragmatic and destructive line on the nanites. And of course, Worf's in the background saying, they are a threat.
Yes, let's destroy them.
Yeah. And so, of course, he's got to be wrong. aside from that, I really like this episode because of the character development that goes on. And it's a bottle show, but it is a well-used bottle show because there's enough character drama to keep it moving along.
I agree. So 2 points to Gryffindor. I don't know what I'm talking about. Suddenly, Harry Potter reference. I don't even like Harry Potter.
If I could counter with a Babylon 5 reference, I'd go with it, but I just can't.
Well, Chip, thank you for joining me on Random Trek.
It was my pleasure, Scott.
Next on Random Trek, Deep Space Nine, Season 6, Episode 11, Waltz.